Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. You can find him on Twitter at HMACBE, HMACBE. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
It's an honor to be on the show.
Hilliard, it looks like your book must be super popular, and if it isn't, it should be, Surviving the Bubble Bursting. Toronto, housing sales down 47%. How much are the prices down in Toronto and Vancouver now?
Well, it's only so far 12 to 13% in the official numbers put out by the Real Estate Association of Toronto and Vancouver. But, you know, there's lots of stories. So I got on Twitter about 2011, I think, and the book, my first edition of my book came out in 2015. The second edition came out in 2018. And so I've got all these people on Twitter that I know over, you know, in the real estate business and that sort of thing. And they post on Twitter examples of houses that have dropped in value in the last few months. Since about March is when the peak was. So going back, what is that? Not even 6 months yet. And some of them are 25, 30%. You know, 1.5 million down to 1.1 million. So officially 12 to 13%, but unofficially probably more like 20, 25%. But, you know, it depends. Like, with, you know, the bigger houses, the more expensive houses, if the seller is desperate, has a problem with the bank or something, then they're going to cut their price faster and deeper than the average person who's just thinking about selling but doesn't desperately need to sell. And some of those people will just sit at the, I've seen so many listings where the people are just asking a price which is too high, but they're not budging. They're not dropping their prices. So the buyers now are refusing to buy. They're refusing to go up to those prices. It's like a standoff. Nobody wants to budge. And this standoff, that's why the number of sales in the headline that you just mentioned, have dropped so drastically, because, there's quite a wide gap between the selling price and the buying price. And nobody wants to make the first move.
Well, also we have an environment of rising interest rates. And when we had record low rates, your monthly mortgage payment was perhaps affordable. But the new environment of super high gasoline and food prices, the price of everything else higher, and your mortgage rate going up, how can you afford to pay more for a house?
Yeah, I mean, the stress test, which they still have in place now, there's a lot of talk and a lot of buzz in the industry and elsewhere about getting rid of the stress test. But the stress test now is you have to be able to meet the posted rate plus 2%. So the posted rate is around 5% right now, so it could be as high as 7% on the stress test. And if you need a big mortgage, those payments are much, much higher than they were just a few months ago. So, and you know, a few months ago, people were, because prices have moved up so rapidly during the COVID era, they were already probably too expensive for most people to be able to afford. You know, they had to really stretch to figure out how to qualify on the debt service ratio requirement and the stress test requirement. So now with interest rates going up, it's going to be very difficult. And you know what else is coming, of course, is the refinancing. Because mortgages, of course, everybody's mortgage, if you've got a fixed rate, it's not really fixed for very long. It's only 5 years maximum. And the variable rates, of course, adjust fairly quickly. So, you know, every month they adjust. So people are already starting to feel the bite, even if they're not. So you got new buyers that don't qualify anymore. So they just disappear unless they can come up with a bigger down payment. And then you've got the existing homeowners that are facing a renewal at a much higher rate. Now, those existing homeowners may not be forced to sell. They might have enough equity in there that they can get along. But the difference is that extra $1,000 a month is money that's not going to be spent at Canadian Tire or at different restaurants or on holidays and stuff. The discretionary spending will drop substantially because people will put a priority on their mortgage.
In this kind of situation, you've seen it before. How long does it take for sellers to realize, I'm not going to move this property at this price, I have to drop it? And also, if you've held that property for 5 or more years, can you still make a handsome profit, even if you have to lower the price?
Well, it's interesting you may bring that up, because it's not the price that people paid for it that is what I call their anchor price. There's a great book by a psychologist, the title's Thinking Fast and Slow, and the guy's name is Daniel Kahneman, and I quote him in my book, and he's got this concept of anchor pricing, and it's the high price that the house sold for that the neighbor sold his house for, which of course the neighbor's house isn't as special as my house because I've spent that extra money on that renovation and I've got a better lot and I've got a better view and all that. So I'm not letting my house go for less than what that neighbor got. But the problem with that analysis is the neighbor sold his house at the peak of the market, and it's no longer the peak of the market. But that anchor price, you say, okay, I'm not going to drop my price below that price because I know I should be getting that price for my house. It takes people a long time to. Some people never are able to get over it. You know, they get really stubborn, and they'll stick with their anchor price for a long time. We did that. In our family, we bought a house in 1990, and we tried to sell it 9 years later, 1999. And we took the price we paid for the house, and then we added the renovation. So we did $50,000 in renovation. So we had paid $300,000, so now we're at $350,000. In our minds, we listed it for $350,000. We thought we deserved that, right? But in the 1990s in Edmonton, housing market was very, very weak, and there's just no buyers at all. It sat for a full year, and we finally dropped the price down to $297,000. So the renovation, we didn't get any of that money back, but we didn't even get our original purchase back quite, but pretty close. But finally, it sold for $297,000. But it took us a year to become convinced that we had to lower our price, and I think it's months. Some people are so stubborn, they'll just pull the house off. If they're not forced to sell, they'll pull the house off the market rather than lower their price. So you could have the standoff periods that we're in now, where there's very few sales because the price of the buyer price and the seller price are just too far apart. And it could sit like that for a long time, except for the possibility that the lender gets involved. So the lenders don't care. Right. So the lenders, they say, oh, I just got to get, you know, if this house is in trouble, it's a foreclosure, it's power of sale, sometimes it's called, depending on the province. They'll just go in and take over the process and say, we're going to sell this house. And then the bank will come after the homeowner for the deficit. And they just put it on the market. And that's when things start to happen, because that sets the new anchor price much lower. And everybody has to recognize that. I mean, the realtors will try and say, oh, that was a foreclosure, it doesn't count. But the buyers look at that and say, no, that's the right price. The new low price is the right price. And so eventually that's what happens. The lenders get, and with the amount of debt that you and I've talked about many, many times, you know, Canada's household debt is one of the highest in the world, more than 100% of GDP. Most of that's in mortgages, by the way. The number of people are likely to get into trouble is quite high. And the thing is, it doesn't take more than 5 or 10% of the people to get into trouble, because it sets the tone for the whole market, right? You got 10 identical houses. Everybody thinks it's worth $1 million. One guy gets into financial trouble and the bank sells the house at $800,000, in foreclosure. Well, all the houses on that street, the other 9 houses, now have to deal with the fact that one of the identical house sold for $800,000. They can't escape it, right? It has to be taken into consideration in terms of if they want to list their house.
Now, some people suggested one of the reasons why property prices went up so high during the pandemic is a lot of governments had moratoriums on foreclosures. Those moratoriums are now gone. And when you have foreclosures, as you mentioned, you get lower prices because the bank doesn't want to hold on to that for any longer than they have to. So they're willing to sell it for a bargain. Does that mean we'll see more bargain homes for sale in Canada?
Well, that's how it'll happen. I mean, if we don't get people being forced to sell at a lower price, they'll basically just be this long period of almost, you know, very few sales, because humans' nature is such that they won't want to drop their prices unless they're forced to. But it's been a long time. Like 2009, for example, the lending industry, not just in Canada, but in the U.S. as well, U.S. was much harsher. But in most parts of Canada, the lending industry took the idea that we'll just help you get through this, right? And so the government did a thing with the banks in Canada where it was called the Insured Mortgage Protection Program, Purchase Program, and they bought a whole bunch of mortgages off the banks. It was huge, you know. The program was authorized for $125 billion, and when the thing was finally closed down, there was $69 billion worth of mortgages that had been bought by the government from the banks. So what that meant was the banks had all of this money from the government in selling their mortgages to the government that they could use to lend again. In fact, they were kind of forced to lend because they're not going to make any money just sitting with cash. So even going back as far back as 2009, that attitude of helping people get through a crisis has been the case. You really have to go back to the 1990s, the early 1990s in Toronto, and the 1980s in Alberta to get to the point where you had widespread foreclosure and selling and bankruptcy action by the banks. It's been a long time. It's been 30 years. So we don't know if it's going to happen this time. I suspect it's going, my base case is that it's going to happen this time. But the people at the banks are, they don't have people that have ever experienced it, right? So they don't even have a department, I don't think. They'll need to gear up with people. One of the things that happened in the 1980s in Alberta, which is, I remember, is the banks changed out all of their people. So the people that had been giving loans out in the boom times in Alberta, big boom in Alberta in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, because oil price went way up, they weren't the right people to be talking foreclosure to the borrowers, right? So they actually sent in some new people who didn't have the personal connection to the people. It was easier for them to foreclose on the loans, and they did a lot of foreclosures. It wasn't just house. It wasn't in those days. It wasn't so much household lending. It was businesses that really got foreclosed on. Very difficult, and of course some of the people that had speculated on housing got hurt too, but. But that was really in Alberta. That was the last time that we had any widespread action like that. And in Toronto, it would have been the early 1990s. So we'll see if it happens again. It'll be new to practically everybody in the system.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, the U.S., two quarters with negative GDP. Many people saying, well, that means officially they're in recession. Others saying, hey, they've got over a million job vacancies. How can they be in recession if people are still looking for employees? Can it be both a recession and a labor shortage?
You know, the recession thing is interesting. So I had to do a little research on this, and it turns out that the Department of Commerce puts out the GDP, but they don't do the call on the recessions. The entity that does the call on recessions is something called a National Bureau of Economic Research. And the committee is called the Business Cycle Dating Committee. And there's eight academics on the committee. And they take into consideration a whole bunch of things, not just GDP. And so it's about four key indicators that they take into consideration, and plus a few others. So they want to see widespread weakness in activity before they'll call a recession. Now, whenever there's been two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, which is what sometimes the regular people like to call a recession, usually the National Bureau of Economic Research eventually calls it a recession as well. So it's actually, there's only been a couple of cases where they didn't. And there was one case actually quite recently, in 2020, when the COVID recession hit, that we didn't ever have, two consecutive quarters of negative growth in GDP, but the National Bureau of Economic Research called it a recession because it was such a deep, slump in activity. So it's just a guideline. But if you wanted to bet, you could say if we have two quarters of negative growth, as we've had the June 30th, March 31st quarter and the June 30th quarter in 2022, they were both negative. They're both likely to be revised. They revised them for months after the first preliminary year, especially the second quarter one. Then you could probably have a pretty good chance of maybe 75, 80, 90%, certainty that eventually they'll call it officially a recession. The problem is, and it's a big problem, the problem is that, they don't get around to it for months after the recession. And sometimes they don't even call it an official recession until the recession's over. So if you're trying to be, to use it as a timing tool for investing, it's a terrible timing tool because you're going to find out way too late that you're in a recession. You might even be already over. So that's why people, probably like to use this two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. But it's interesting now because the market is actually, we've had quite a rally the last month, probably 5 weeks now. And, it's because, the people in the market are assuming because we had two quarters of negative growth, the Federal Reserve will have to back off on the interest rate hikes and they'll start to cut interest rates, you know, fairly soon, say in the fall. And I don't think that's going to happen, but, a lot of the people in the market are betting on that and they might be right. It's just, we don't know, but, other central banks take a different approach, like the Bank of England is taking a much different approach to the whole thing.
Canada had a $5 billion trade surplus in June. Is it because of the low Canadian dollar or the fact that we have a lot of oil and gas we can ship out and make record profits on?
It's the latter. It's the oil and gas because our checked our currency. It's only down two cents. Roughly a year ago, roughly was 80 cents. And today it's roughly 78 cents, a little bit under 78 cents. It's only gone down 2%. In England, the pound, British pound, has gone down 12% in the same period. So our currency is down a little bit, but it's really the terms of trade. The price of oil was up above $100 for quite a long time. It's well down now. It's down in the 80s now, but for all of June, it was well above $100. So that's what made the difference. You know, in our case, it's either auto parts, auto sales, auto manufacturing, or oil and gas. They kind of compete to be the top value export. When the price of oil is above $70 or $80, it's usually always oil. And when the price of oil is down around $30 or $40, then it becomes auto parts and automobile manufacturing. But that automobile thing is starting to get quite shaky because Canada has not get. We haven't got the production increases like we used to get, and there's only a tiny amount of so far. Hopefully there'll be more announcements in the future, but so far there's only been a tiny amount of electric car announcements where they're going to bring the production to Canada. For years now, the Americans have been moving their production to places like Mexico and southern U.S. states that are where they can get a really good deal on taxes and labor costs, and Canada's just become way too expensive.
You know what Canada should be building? Martin Mars flying bombers, air bombers for fighting forest fires. The rest of the world is now joining North America in record-setting forest fires. The Martin Mars can scoop up 8,000 gallons in less than 30 seconds and be on target within minutes. If you put modern turboprop engines on a plane like that, it can carry more and go faster. Canada should be in the Martin Mars water bomber business.
That's a great idea. I know the my neighbor here, because we both had airplanes, he flew airplanes, but his main thing was he owned a firefighting water bomber fleet. And the planes he has, and now I'm going to forget what the names was, but they were like vintage World War II kind of planes. He was using, he wouldn't buy the new ones. And most of his pilots were a lot of them had flown in the military in the Vietnam War or whatever. So they were still fighting fires using that equipment. So if there's a new one, then that would be great. Because it's for sure the forest fires are with us now. I don't think it's too bad in Canada yet, but there's a big one in Northern California. So I suspect that it's coming to here right around this time of the year. We usually get the, it's interesting because I live in Edmonton. The smoke comes all the way to Edmonton and Calgary from BC. So it's amazing how far the smoke can travel.
Saw a great documentary on the Martin Marr's water bomber. It was contracted by Mexico for 3 months to fight forest fires. It came home after a month because it had put all the fires out. It puts out 4 acres of fire at a time. 4 acres. Right now, they're using these little pontoon planes to do it. Their water, 800 gallons, evaporates before it even gets near the fire. BC also uses a unique way to pay for it. They look at how much it costs per hour to fight a fire, not how many liters per hour you can put on the fire. It's a false saving. Again, every forest fire year in BC, people call for the Martin Marr's. The government comes up with 1,000 excuses, and I know the owners of Coulson air tankers have just given up. They get better reception for their equipment and personnel going to places like Australia, where their talent's appreciated. Isn't that just typically Canadian? We don't appreciate our talent until it goes elsewhere.
You know, the that bomber, there aren't very many of them in existence, so they're pretty hard to get your hands on.
But that's why we should be building them. We should be building them.
We could build a replica. Yeah, we could build a replica.
Yes, exactly. We should be building them. Elon Musk, if you're listening, help us build more Martin Marr's with modern 10,000 horsepower turboprop engines instead of 5,000 horsepower ancient radial engines. That's there my rant for today.
There's one for sale for $5 million, Jim, so you should just go out and do a GoFundMe thing to buy a Martin Marr's plane for $5 million and then rent it out for fighting fires.
That's what Elon pays for lunch every day, isn't it?
27,000 liters of water in one go. Wow.
Yeah. It's like having 10 fire trucks in the sky dumping their load all at once. Hilliard, anything else that we should be keeping an eye on economically?
So the one thing that the big question is the inflation rate, right? So in Canada, the inflation rate, the latest reports were around 8%, a little over 8%. The U.S. is over 9%. And today, the Bank of England came out and said that they're forecasting that inflation is going to peak at 13.3%. by the end of 2022, so in the next few months. And so that is the key thing to watch, because that'll force the hand of the Federal Reserve, what they do with interest rates. So the interest rate went up in England half a percentage point today. That was the biggest increase in several decades. But that only gets the rate to 1.75%. So inflation is going to be 13.3, but the official interest rate is only 1.75. It just doesn't add up. So that's the key thing to watch. If inflation stays more persistent than the market is expecting, the market's expecting inflation to come down quickly. And if it doesn't come down quickly, then watch out for higher interest rates coming. And, you know, it's not all bad. It's bad for people that want to buy houses or sell a house because it makes it much more expensive. But there's a lot of people with cash that would love to be getting 5 or 6% on a GIC. And there's some positives that would come from higher interest rates as well.
Why have the big banks been so slow to boost the interest paid on savings accounts? Because they're greedy?
Because they can get away with it, I guess.
It's
like if people knew what they could get on just on a preferred share or some government bonds or any kind of other facility like that, they wouldn't let the bank do that to them. But most people don't, you know, they don't have the energy or the get up and go to, they're just kind of complacent and they let the bank roll it over. But if rates go much higher, people will start shopping around. For so long, it didn't make any difference because the rates were so low. But when rates are higher, people start to get a little more interested and they start shopping around a little bit more. And that's when you start seeing some action.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. Check out his website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Find him on Twitter at HMACBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or any of our other guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.